Welcome to Crime Soup Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Carter.
And I'm Hannah.
And this week we'll be discussing the complexity of convicting rapists and how our justice system fails victims of rape. Most of what we know about the crimes perpetuated against Pauline come from Dr. Anne Burgess, the woman we famously know from her years at Quantico, who pioneered the concept of criminal profiling. Dr. Burgess started as a psychiatric nurse in the 1960s, when the field was still new. Her special interest in victims of sexual trauma was still uncharted territory, a topic that she quickly learned nobody wanted to talk about. But it was a large-scale problem, with almost 38,000 cases reported in 1970 alone, compounded by a lack of treatment options available for victims who struggled with the psychological aftermath. Through countless interviews and one-on-one sessions with victims of sexual assault, Dr. Burgess and her colleague, Linda Holmstrom, compiled enough data to begin recognizing patterns of criminal behavior and eventually published an article in the American Journal of Nursing in 1973 titled, "The Rape Victim in the Emergency Ward." And in 1974, they followed up with a second major paper in the American Journal of Psychiatry titled Rape Trauma Syndrome. It was these articles that caught the attention of the FBI, who had been struggling to understand the nature of sexual criminals and why sexual crimes had risen so dramatically in the late 1970s. Nobody at the FBI knew anything about sexual violence, and it was becoming a problem, which is why they contacted Dr. Burgess in 1978 to give a professional lecture at Quantico. Dr. Burgess recalls in a quote, "The audience for my first lecture at the FBI Academy consisted of a group of 40 or so male agents who, for the most part, looked exactly like their pop culture portrayals on TV. Rugged athletes with fresh crew cuts dressed in near-identical crisp blue shirts." To illustrate the complexity of investigating sexual crimes, Dr. Burgess used the case of Pauline in her first lecture at Quantico. This description of Pauline's case was given in Chapter 7 of Dr. Burgess's book, A Killer by Design, published in 2021. Pauline was attacked on a Thursday afternoon in June of 1976. She was changing trains at a suburban station in the rush of midday traffic. She had just finished shopping and was the last passenger out of the subway car, distracted by thoughts of a long list of chores waiting for her back home, when suddenly she felt herself pulled backwards in a violent jerking motion. She looked behind her, wondering if her purse had been caught in the train door, but as she turned, a gloved hand covered her mouth just as an arm tightened around her waist. She tried to scream, but couldn't. She tried to fight the person off, but his grip was too strong. Passengers crisscrossed around her without seeming to notice. It was the bystander effect in full force. Pauline felt completely helpless as she was pulled across the busy platform and down a ladder into the station's catacombs. End quote. Pauline was viciously beaten and raped in the catacombs just beneath a busy train station in the middle of the day, but despite surviving the attack, her trauma was far from over. Pauline's lawyer reached out to Dr. Burgess to perform a forensic psychiatric evaluation to measure the impact the event had on Pauline's life. Pauline's evaluation was not unusual. In fact, her experience of coping with sexual violence and her ability to recount the attack followed suit with other victims that Dr. Burgess had studied. Something that Dr. Burgess and her colleague Linda Holmstrom had learned while interviewing so many victims of sexual assault was that the human brain, in order to protect itself from traumatic memories, would only remember selective bits of information, some of it seemingly unimportant, and sometimes wouldn't be able to recount more obvious or important details about the event. For example, Pauline could remember the sound of train cars, the smell of vinegar, the gloves her attacker was wearing, but she couldn't remember his face. She couldn't remember the most important piece of information about the attack. Pauline, like many surviving victims of violent crime, would need to recount every excruciating detail of the most traumatic moment of her life if she wanted her attacker to face justice. And if her memory wasn't perfect, if she got any of her details wrong, the prosecution could turn the jury against her. When Dr. Burgess presented this case to those 40 or so FBI agents at Quantico in 1978, she received a very apt question from a member of the audience, which was, "What if they're making the whole thing up?" To this question, Dr. Burgess explained, "That should be pretty far down on your list of things to worry about. I'd suggest not leading with assumptions. It does more damage than good. And you'll do better if you stick to facts. In the case of traumatic experiences, the facts are usually pretty well established and clear." Pauline pressed charges against Consolidated Rail Corp., the owner of the train station, which meant that she had to recount her attack in court and be cross-examined by the railway's defense team. They asked her about the offender's clothes, about visual details within the station, and about the day's weather and other peripheral details. Pauline was confused at some points and recalled some details inaccurately. After each mistake, the defense corrected her in front of the jury, using the opportunity to describe Pauline as unreliable and disingenuous. The defense used the public's ignorance about how our brains remember traumatic events against Pauline, which illustrates one major reason why rape is one of the most commonly acquitted crimes in the world. But luckily, Dr. Burgess took the stand in Pauline's trial, and her professional expertise on rape trauma helped Pauline win $750,000 for damages. Unfortunately, Pauline's attacker was never caught, and there are several strikingly similar crimes against women that could be linked to the same man. Investigators found no witnesses to Pauline's attack, the station didn't have cameras, and security guards claimed they hadn't seen anyone suspicious at the time noted in Pauline's claim. However, a woman named Joan, who was found brutally attacked and raped in the exact same train station, her body found in the same catacombs only months after Pauline's assault, had an eyewitness. Joan's injuries were significantly worse than Pauline's. She was found in a puddle of blood, barely alive, her head smashed against the pavement floor. She was comatose for 45 days after the attack. Due to the severity of her brain injuries, Joan couldn't even remember the assault. But there was one woman at the train station that day who saw Joan being taken down to the catacombs. She saw the perpetrator's face and testified in court. But despite this woman's testimony, the suspect was acquitted. Those who followed the case were shocked. Several people audibly gasped. The prosecutor hurried from the courtroom, ignoring the request by the press for comment. Only the defendant and his defense attorney smiled. Sadly, the outcome wasn't surprising. It followed a pattern common to many rape trials around the country at that time. Victims had the deck stacked against them. Part of this was because rape kits were still uncommon and DNA profiling wouldn't exist for several more years, but the bigger truth was that rape was often a man's word versus a woman's word, and women were viewed as unreliable, emotional, and untrustworthy, meaning that in cases like these, juries rarely believed the victims. So something I've learned about the justice system is that in reality, it really only works at its best for property crimes, and even then, it's still It's easier to tell the victim of rape, "That sucks, there's nothing we can do about it," than to actually address the issues causing it, or even holding perpetrators accountable, because to actually do something about it means we would have to change the structures of our society. We would have to change the way society views women, or thinks about women. And where do we even start to enact change on that level if the men perpetuating the system don't want to change, or if worse, they don't even see the problems?
One of the biggest questions that first came up when you started saying that, when you're talking about the societal issue, something that really bothers me is the number that Dr. Burgess gives us in her book, which is that in 1970, there are 38,000 cases, not just total, but just reported in 1970 of sexual assault. And we know that the FBI calls her in 1978 to give her first lecture. And the reason they call her is because they say that the numbers, like the sharp increase in sexual assaults that they're having to deal with, are so high that they need to bring in experts. And we don't have an answer to this, but I want to know what your theories are. Why do you think, or maybe can you guess, why there was such a sharp increase in sexual assault cases in the late 1970s?
Okay, this is super interesting. And there's a lot of different avenues we could go down to explore. But one of my theories is that sexual assault wasn't really a thing that was reported before the 70s, really, because women were considered property for most of the time before that. And I don't think they really thought of sexual assault as a thing that happened to them or something they could really do anything about. It was more of like a character flaw in women. Like if you were out late at night and you got raped, it was because you were out late at night. If you were a woman who worked and you got raped at work, it was because you were a working woman and that was a moral flaw on your part and you deserved it in some way. And so when the sexual liberation started happening in the late 60s and the early 70s in the United States, that's when women started getting an education about sexual coercion and sexual assault and having basically control over their own body to some extent. And once you get an education about you own your body and you don't have to do things you don't want to do and things that people do to you against your will are not okay, you're probably going to get a spike in reports about sex crimes, because before that it just probably wasn't a thing.
So I didn't even, like, that was kind of in the back of my mind, but that is genius. So that's, I think that's definitely one of the bigger things. I think you're onto something. Like, that's probably the leading thing, is that we have second wave feminism in the 1970s, right?
Yeah.
So you have all these women who are being empowered. You have all these feminist leaders. You've got, like, the first women who are, like, running for political office, and they're really being seen. And you've got, like, Betty Friedan writing The Feminine Mystique. And you've got just all these women who are openly talking about the reality of being a woman.
Yeah.
So that's definitely one thing. The other thing that I was thinking about, and this is completely conjecture, but I was listening to a podcast recently. It was actually Freakonomics, and they were talking about why in the 1990s, the United States had such low crime rates. Like, there was a huge dip in crime rates.
Mm-hmm.
And the researcher, he explored all of these different avenues, and he, like, dove into all these different things, and he discovered that the number one cause for this dip in crime rates was that abortion had been legalized about 20 years prior to that in the 70s. And so when you see trends in society, the people who commit crimes are usually between, like, 18 and 25, roughly, right? They're usually young. Usually the demographic is, like, young men, 18 to 25, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at what was happening 20 years prior to that trend, so here you're having these sexual assaults. And if you're going to assume that in 1978, when Quantico is calling up Ann Burgess and they've got all of these sexual assaults, assuming that the assailants are also roughly 18 to 25 mm-hmm. that are committing these crimes, what was happening 20 years before that when they were being born? Like, who was raising them and what were the conditions of their birth? And, like, this might be a wild...
Yeah.
This might be a wild theory, but
no.
20 years before 1978 would have been 1958. So these people are being born in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
The women who are raising them are 1950s housewives.
Yep.
And something that, like, Betty Friedan talked about in her book in the 1970s in The Feminine Mystique is she pulls the cover off of what it's actually like being a 1950s housewife and how unhappy they are and how they think that they've been sold this American dream. But taking care of kids and taking care of a house is actually a lot of work, and it's also not terribly fulfilling for most people,
mm-hmm.
male or female. And a lot of these women at the time were getting prescribed experimental drugs.
Yeah.
I think some of the drugs were just straight up meth,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And I was talking to my husband about this, and I was like, what if one of the reasons, maybe not the leading reason, but maybe one of the reasons that you have all of these criminals in the late 70s who have no respect for women and are assaulting women are because they were raised by women who didn't stick up for themselves, who were miserable, who were being prescribed all these drugs, and how many of them maybe were taking those drugs while they were pregnant?
Yep. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think it was a lot of things, and I think that's absolutely one of the main things. And also, have you seen some of the parenting books that came out in the 1950s? Like,
oh.
That's when we were first introduced to, like, crying it out method and treating your little boys differently than little girls. Like, little boys do not deserve any type of physical affection, and they should not be doted on, and they should be treated like grown men from the time that they're infants. And also, like, right along the vein of mothers being prescribed literal methamphetamines while they were pregnant, probably, and then after, but, like, lead-based paint and all of the other toxic, poisonous things that were just being mm-hmm. consumed like normal absolutely had an effect on brain functions. Like, I totally believe that theory. I think you're right on the money.
So we've got, like, a combination of things,
yeah.
right? So we've got, like, feminism in the 1970s that's kind of like, hey, we should talk about this. And then you've got all these men who they were raised by unhappy women,
yep.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Who maybe weren't given the best parenting advice and weren't prescribed like the best medications.
Yeah.
Or were over-medicated or whatever. Are there any other theories? Like, why would we suddenly see a giant spike in the late 1970s? Is there anything else?
So I think a lot of things played into this, and I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's a lot of things. But I guess my theory is that life was just a lot more traumatic in different ways in the 50s and for a lot of different reasons. Like think about the wars that they just lived through and the Great Depression and we haven't even touched on like the intersectionality of like race issues and stuff like that and how traumatic that is living through something like that. But trauma affects the brain in lots of different ways, and it can rewire your brain. And I think trauma is the reason people react violently a lot of times.
So do you think that, so you're referring specifically to the men who are perpetrating the violent crime, like you think that they've absorbed maybe like generational trauma? Is that what you're referring to? Or are you talking about their mothers?
I mean, everybody went through trauma and everybody had trauma affected the brain. But yes, I guess perpetrators are created or can be created, not all the time, but I think they can be created through traumatic experiences.
I think it's interesting. You specifically mentioned that one of the parenting styles at the time in the 50s and 60s was like the, especially towards boys, like not showing affection.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't know that was like an actual like published finding or that it was in parenting books, but
yeah.
I've seen it firsthand. My husband actually talks about it a lot because his father has mentioned that his own mother, so this is two generations back, right?
Yeah.
That my husband's grandmother essentially didn't hug her son or show him like physical affection. And to this day, and he's in his like late 50s, early 60s now, he still thinks about it and he still doesn't like it and he talks about it.
Yeah.
Just like that simple absence of like motherly affection and hugs and kisses, like it affects a person.
Yeah.
And it affects, I think, attachment.
Exactly. I have lots of things to say on attachments and attachment theory and stuff like that. But humans are social creatures and they need affection and what's the word I'm looking for? And camaraderie and community. And when you're missing that, I think it does something to your brain and therefore your personality and therefore your behavior.
So one more thing, Dr. Burgess, actually, in her book, she talks about why people commit sexual assault. And when she was lecturing to those FBI agents who were all male, she wanted to make it very clear that sexual assault and sex are two very, very different things, and they're done for very different reasons. I think a lot of people accidentally link sexual assault with like lust or affection or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
But she actually drives home the point that sexual assault is about control. And people who commit sexual assault oftentimes are trying to feel like they have control of something because other things in their life at the time maybe are out of control. A lot of times the perpetrators are scared or feel helpless, and so they want to make someone else feel scared and helpless so that someone else feels the way that they do.
Yeah.
And talking about how this is a time they're recovering, the U.S. is recovering from the war in Vietnam, there could be a lot of fear, there could be a lot of helplessness, there could be a lot of people who just feel scared and out of control. They feel like their circumstances are out of their control, and so they're projecting it onto other people and trying to make other people suffer like they feel like they're suffering.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Not to try and, like, justify why people commit sexual assault, obviously.
No, absolutely not. We can pathologize and we can try and figure it out. Like, that's not
an
excuse.
Because, like, how else would we stop it? And that's what Amber just was trying to do. Like,
yeah.
She was doing all this research because she was like, how do we stop this from happening? Like, instead of just helping rape victims, which is important, how do we stop them from even being raped in the first place? Because that should be the number one goal.
Yeah.
Is to stop it before it even happens.
Yeah.
So I also want to talk about Pauline specifically. So the case that Dr. Burgess mentions when she gives her first lecture at Quantico about Pauline getting abducted in the busy train station, that happened in 1976. And she gets abducted. She gets kind of dragged across the platform in the middle of the day, and she gets taken down into the catacombs where she's assaulted and just abandoned, right? Nothing about that story, in my opinion, is surprising, for one. I know Dr. Burgess used it to kind of illustrate this extraordinary case to these FBI agents. I think the only thing that's even slightly eyebrow-raising is that it was in the middle of the day and there were so many people around. But honestly, I've heard stories where women are assaulted on public transportation and there's people on the same train car or on the same bus and they just watch it happen, or they record it on their phones and nobody intervenes.
Yeah.
But what do you think? Like, does this sound dated? Like, does it sound like something from the 1970s or?
No, like this could have happened yesterday and it would have, number one, not surprised me, unfortunately. Number two, nothing about it seems like far away or distant. And about in the middle of the day, like, I remember taking a self-defense class when I was a teenager, and the self-defense instructor told us, never shout help while you're being raped. If you're being raped, never shout help, because no one will help you. Shout fire. Shout something that affects more than just you, because that's the only way people will help. And people get assaulted in the middle of the day all the time. It doesn't change anything. Shout fire is what she told us to do.
I've heard that too. And that actually also makes me wonder, is there anything that Pauline could have done better to protect herself, to have survived? Like, did she fail in any way to, like, make herself a victim in this circumstance?
No. I mean, yes, she could have been a superhuman with eyes in the back of her head and had magical superpowers that gave her super strength to fight off her attacker. Like, she didn't do anything wrong. She didn't do anything to put herself in a harmful position, and she didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, and it's infuriating. Yeah. Like just because you said, like, she should, like, people should yell fire or whatever, I was like, her mouth was covered. She, like, tried to yell and she couldn't, right? She had a man who, they never caught him, so I don't know how big, how tall, how strong he was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was strong enough that she couldn't yell.
Yeah.
And she couldn't fight back. Like, he had such a strong grip on her. She describes just, like, not being able to move.
And people
saw. I don't know how big she was.
Yeah, like, people saw. It was in the middle of the day. He drug her past people. Like, and nobody did anything.
That's wild to me. I know it happens, but here's my question is, I've always heard that rape is hard to convict because it's quote-unquote usually committed in isolated places.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually in, like, the privacy of homes, bedrooms, back alleys. Like, people try and find a secluded place, which this guy did too, but he actually abducted her in plain sight.
Yeah.
In front of, I don't even know how many people, right? But a train station. It was in Philadelphia. This is, yeah, a big city. It's probably bustling.
And in the middle of the day.
So what does that tell you about this guy?
He's a bold one, that's for sure.
He's done it. He's definitely done it before.
Yeah, he felt safe enough to do it.
Like, that would be my first assumption. And I don't know who it was, but you would have to know that you could get away with it.
Yeah.
Because that's very bold.
Yeah.
Do you think he, like, worked up to it? Like, he did, like, small things, just grabbed a woman here and there, or, like, you know what I mean? And then worked his way up until he's like, I could straight up abduct someone and nobody would notice. And then he just did it.
Maybe. And maybe that was the midpoint onto what he was really wanting to do. Maybe he was, like, a serial killer. Who knows what this creep did before he got to that point, but it's just really devastating that he wasn't caught.
Here's the other thing, is there were security guards there that day. They didn't see anything, and the station didn't have any security cameras. And, like, that's not a 1970s thing. I'm sure there's a lot of public places that, yeah, they've got a security guard. No, we don't have security cameras. And you could be easily abducted in the middle of the day and there would be no eyewitnesses or any kind of video surveillance.
Well, even if there was video surveillance, if the person who abducted you had their face and any defining features covered, I mean, they would use that to their advantage too. That wouldn't necessarily convict someone just because you saw them do it. So it's infuriating.
So I really want to talk about I want to talk about specifically why it's so hard to convict rapists.
Okay.
Because Ann Burgess does a pretty good job using this case as an example, teaching this to the FBI agents at Quantico, talking specifically about the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
The human brain plays a big part in why rape convictions don't happen. I don't know. Have you had any kind of like first or secondhand experience with people who, I don't know, I remember learning in a psychology class in college about how the human brain like will blot out traumatic events.
Yeah.
Has this ever happened in like any famous cases that women have brought forward or victims of rape have brought forward? Or like, do you know anyone that that's happened to?
Yeah. So, you know, I used to work in a special victims unit, and I used to help interview sexual assault victims. And then I would go to court and like watch the process basically pan out. And I cannot tell you how many times the defense was able to twist something that happened to the victim, or the victim's testimony would change because they would give their testimony right after it happened and then again 3 days afterwards, because that's just the way your brain works. And that's scientifically backed, that if you take the testimony of a rape victim or something that traumatic happens to you, right, take a testimony right after it happens versus a couple days after or even a couple weeks after, you're going to remember more details. More things are going to come to you, or your testimony will change a little bit as time goes on. And the defense would absolutely use that to tear apart the victim on the stand and when they cross-examined them. And it was not fair at all.
So, okay. So, I mean, that's a huge flaw, obviously.
Yeah.
So we have this glaring issue where you have people who they're doing the best they can and they're doing the best that their brain can do, and they're remembering details days, weeks, months later, right, as it becomes clear and they've kind of processed their trauma.
Yeah.
Which obviously processing trauma sometimes takes days, weeks, months, years, decades.
Yeah.
How do we deal with that? How do we prove a rape conviction when all you have sometimes is no physical evidence, but you have an eyewitness, which we know is not a reliable witness all the time, and you have a victim who is only remembering bits and pieces? How do you convict a rapist without interrogating and just re-traumatizing the victim as they have to share and reshare these details over and over again and just keep tearing that wound back open?
Okay, so I don't think there's a definitive answer to that question. I don't think there's something that I can say like, this is what will stop it, right? And I have the solution to all the things. No, I don't think anyone would be able to give us that. But I have a lot of opinions about this, and this is kind of long-winded, but bear with me. So first and foremost, we stop letting untrained police officers work on sex crimes cases, like point blank. And I might lose some of you here, but follow along with me. So speaking from experience, when I worked in a special victims unit, and this is one of the things that absolutely radicalized me into what I am today.
What you are today.
And I am radical. The people who worked on sex crimes were there on a volunteer basis because no one wanted to work in the SVU. So they took detective volunteers with no special or specific training required, and it wasn't needed to apply for the position if you were already a detective. Or there weren't volunteers, and often there weren't. And if that were the case, the detectives were put on a rotation. So like every 3 years, it depends on the department, honestly, a new detective was assigned to the special victims unit. So often those detectives didn't even want to be there, didn't have a passion for helping victims or solving sex crimes. And let's be honest, they were absolutely not suited for that work at all. And like, detectives were sent to trainings after they were assigned, but 9 times out of 10, those trainings were taught by other detectives in other police departments who were also working in the special victims unit and had been assigned the same way. So they were sharing their experiences and their perspectives, not necessarily facts or science or actually how to help victims. It was a lot of training on processes, and I went to a lot of these trainings. It was absolutely training on processes, on how to deal with cases, not necessarily
how to deal with people.
Yes, anything productive, actually. So this is why often police departments have victims advocates who work parallel to the detectives to try and help the victims through the court process, and so the detectives don't have to. And this is kind of parallel, but I wanted to touch on this because I think it's important. The police department hardly ever, I think it's unheard of, pays for the victim's advocate positions. It's a grant position. So to start a victim's advocate program in your city, you have to have somebody who knows how to write grant letters. They have to write letters to the state and federal governments asking for grants to sponsor their positions. And sometimes they don't get funding because they didn't write the grant well enough. They didn't write asking for the grant well enough. So then there's no victims advocates in your area. But the victims advocates are amazing, considering I don't really like the way that the system works. But the victim advocates are amazing and they do really awesome work. They're fully invested in the cases and the people affected. And they're the ones that help you get protection orders, the ones that provide resources for when you leave abusive situations and advice on how to press charges. Like they do a lot of really awesome work to see you through on the other side after the hard thing happens. But long story short, I think ultimately to help victims of rape specifically without re-traumatizing them means changing the system altogether. I think that only a specifically trained social worker should be allowed to help rape victims. People with like an actual education about psychology, biology, mental health, and the legal system should be allowed to handle these cases, because our justice system is extremely careless with victims of rape.
They're treating victim advocates like a luxury.
Exactly.
Like it's something that's unnecessary. Uh-huh. That you have to write this grant for. It sounds like it's getting swept under the rug as like, well, that's just extra work for us.
Well, they're presuming.
And we already have so much work on our plate that we don't want to add. It's like the rape kits,
yeah.
Right?
Well, and they're having presuming that, that men are the default at that point.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So it sounds like it's just like, that's too much work for us.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, it is a lot of work. And you're talking about like, well, cops shouldn't be the ones doing it.
They shouldn't. From what I saw, they absolutely shouldn't.
We are so close to getting this figured out, guys. They're like, we don't want to do this, but we are, but we're not.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just pay us to do it, and then we won't do it.
Yep, there it is. Ding, ding.
Crap, I figured it out.
Yep.
So Pauline's case happened in the 1970s. So that was, what, like 50 years ago. Since then, since the 70s, we've developed rape kits and we've developed DNA technology. So it seems like things should be improved since then. Like so much has happened in history between the 1970s and now. Technology-wise, we've made so many advancements. So have things actually gotten better, and how have things changed when it comes to prosecuting rapists and getting justice for victims?
Oh boy, do I have some thoughts on this. Okay, so this is also a long-winded assessment. So rape kits were seen as revolutionary when the technology was implemented in criminal justice. And now I feel like after 44 years, almost 50 years of practicing with them, number one, they're only as helpful as far as the system is useful. So like, is the crime lab only testing a few rape kits a year? How many crime labs per state are there? That's really common for kits to be put on the back burner and they sit in an evidence room for months at best and at worst years. And we have a stat that says that there's over 225,000 kits untested that are sitting in evidence rooms, in evidence warehouses. But 15 states and many large cities declined to answer how many rape kits they have untested sitting on their shelves. So it's probably an even larger number than that. So most rape kits are never even processed. And number two, rape kits are extremely expensive. So they can cost at least anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500. Your insurance doesn't have to cover it, and they probably don't, let's be honest. And if they do cover it, it's probably only a small percentage, so you're screwed if you don't have insurance at all. And three, it's not talked about enough how violating the procedure of collecting evidence and samples can be for victims. It's extremely invasive and physically painful. And not to mention, it can take hours of waiting in an emergency room and then hours of being poked and prodded and scraped in your most vulnerable reproductive areas. And oftentimes, they take pictures as well. So it re-victimizes you all over again a lot of times, not only because the process can be invasive, and while we can't really prevent that, I guess there's ways we can make it easier on victims. It's not a simple procedure, and we often oversimplify it. Long story short, I guess to answer your question, if rape kits make it easier for victims to seek justice, I think the answer is no. And not because the technology or the thought isn't good, because it absolutely is. The technology isn't the problem, because the technology has only gotten better over time. But sex crimes aren't a priority to solve, so the technology doesn't matter, and therefore they're not helpful. Pauline's perpetrator was never caught, which is unfortunate, but not uncommon. Over 225,000 rape kits, at least, are sitting untested today. If that pisses you off, spread the word and contact your state officials to tell them this isn't okay. Go to endthebacklog.org for more information. In 1977, 1 in 3 reported rapes resulted in a conviction. In 1999, it was 1 in 13. For the last reported year, 2013, less than 1% of reported rapes end with felony conviction. Fight for police reform, but in the meantime, go see if your city has a victim advocacy program and support them in any way you can. They are the last good defense for the justice of rape and abuse victims. Crime Soup listeners, my Chef Boyardee demons. Be sure to find us on Instagram at crime_soup and TikTok at Crime Soup Podcast. Tune in next Tuesday for your next helping of delicious crime soup. Bon appetit!